The Ocelli Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck Ocelli.
The second day of February 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And this indeed is the show you were looking for. How do I know that? You can hear me tap on my mic stand, so there it is. Okay. Anyway, glad to have you along, and hopefully everything is functioning properly. It looks like we're streaming live like we should on the audio, but this is also being recorded via video tonight, which is unusual and not something I'm happy about, but because I certainly don't want to look at me. But thankfully, I have guests. So what do we have? All right. In the first hour, I've got Charlie Robinson with me. In the second hour, I've got Roberta Glass with me. So if you're not aware of who it is we're talking about, you're going to find out real soon. How about that? Anyway, let's just roll straight on into it. I'm not going to cover news or anything else. Glad to have you along, though, no matter who you are, where you are, when you are, because most of you catch the podcast. Anyway, technical issues aside, Charlie Robinson, how are you doing tonight, man?
I'm good, man. Happy Groundhog's Day to you.
Oh, yeah, that too, right?
Yeah, it's when Justin Trudeau comes out, if he sees his shadow, there's going to be six more weeks of trucker blockades.
Nice. Punxsutawney Justin.
Yep.
Send him to Pennsylvania. I don't think they want him, though. Anyways, let's just dispense with it. I mean, how would you introduce yourself? I mean, obviously, people should know you're a content creator of sorts, and I know that's an overused phrase, et cetera, et cetera. You kind of look like a little bit like me with the glasses and everything. I'm half blind, though, so I'm only looking at this little picture of you.
Uh-huh.
And I almost think I'm looking at myself, except I got the bandana to keep the hair from getting tangled in the
I don't have that problem. There's a hair shortage happening on my head, a bad one.
It looked a little shiny, but then again, I'm like legally blind, so I didn't know if I'm seeing things or not.
No, you're unfortunately seeing what you see.
Glasses are thicker, but okay.
It's a mess. How would I introduce myself? I would say I am I'm an author. I've written three books. First one was The Octopus of Global Control. I wrote a book called The Controlled Demolition of the American Empire with a guy named Jeff Berwick, who is the dollar vigilante. That's a number one bestseller in Australia and the United States. We're very proud of that. And my newest book, Hypocrisy, Surviving in a World of Cultural Double Standards, is out. So I've got three books, and I've got a podcast called Macroaggressions, which is available wherever podcasts are, in audio format and in video format. I've got it on David Icke's platform, Iconic. It's on Rockfin. It's on Band.video. So I'm planting my proverbial flags wherever I can, because they've made it so difficult for the messages to get out that you have to do that. And I also do a group podcast with a couple guys called The Union of the Unwanted, and that is where we bring in content creators, we bring in experts, we pick a topic, and we just have a big group roundtable discussion about it. We've had great guests on. We've had all the doctors that get Joe Rogan in trouble have been on our show and talking about, you know, the unspeakable and things like that. So we're just doing it. I'm trying to cover, you know, mostly I'd rather do a podcast about football. But until we get these problems sorted out and that these maniacs have put in our way, I feel like I have to prioritize and focus on the things that are important. So until that time, the football podcast is on hold.
I got you. Listen, I'll tell you, in a world that I didn't think was so psychologically, emotionally, and spiritually disturbed, I might just be spinning records. I love music. I might be a radio DJ.
Yeah.
You know, it would be fun. I didn't make it as a musician, but I still, you know, kind of play with that a little bit. But honestly, that's probably what I would do. I would just, hey, here's AC/DC. This is what I would do.
And when we get to that point where you're doing when you're a DJ dealing with music and I'm a podcast guy dealing with sports, we'll get together and we'll talk about how successful it must be a success if we're able to do these other things. We must have solved a bunch of these other problems, because they seem so overwhelming right now. But I feel like the first step, if we're going to get past all these things, is talking about it, you know, getting the word out to people, and let's have the discussion, and let's see if we can change some of the you know, the direction that we're headed as a society, because I think everyone would agree that it's not good. It hasn't been good for a while. We're being led astray by some very dangerous individuals that have a much different plan for us than we're being told about. And so if we get to the point where we're doing shows on other topics, we'll know that the battle has been won then.
Absolutely. And look, if listeners think that Union of the Unwanted sounds familiar, I think it's because Ricky Mirandez is also involved there, the host of the Ripple Effect. And he's been on my show a couple of times now. I haven't been on his show yet, but he's been on my show a couple of times.
I'll talk to Rick. I'll send him a text.
That's all right. Listen, it's funny. I didn't discover him, and he was doing it about as long as I was. And I sat there one day and noticed on Twitter the Ripple Effect, and I almost thought, is this somebody copying what I'm doing, kind of? And it turns out, no. Independently, each of us, without having full awareness of one another, sort of – had the same idea, except he's done it better. What can I say?
He's Portuguese, so he says it's the Portuguese in me. I like to talk. I can't stop talking. So he's born to talk, you know. So you are at a severe disadvantage going up. We all are going up against Ricky. He can talk your ears off.
Well, see, but I'm Sicilian, so I never forget.
Ooh, that might be a good grudge match then. That might be a nice battle.
You know, battle of the wills, you never know. And we could get into all the ethnic things and all that, but there's many more important things to get to. The titles of your books, now I was aware of Union of the Unwanted, but I have not read these books, okay? I'll be honest with you. I don't ever try to act like I've read something when I haven't. I've read many different authors, and a lot of them, unfortunately, who have even sent me their books, I got to tell you, it's like, yeah, okay, waste of time, but sadly, and I've interviewed hundreds of authors.
We got an audiobook for Controlled Demolition. You can listen to that if you want.
No problem. Audiobooks all day long. But I love audiobooks. I got a few of them behind me. But anyways, thing is, your titles are interesting enough. Now you got the octopus in there. I'm just curious, are we talking Danny Casolaro, or are we talking the generalized octopus that is the panopticon of various weaponry that I feel as though has been completely trained on the human family? Are we talking about a generality, or are we talking about a specific thing here?
We're talking about a generality, though I must say that both Danny Casolaro and I both wrote our octopus books when we were 44 years old and put them out. And then he wound up packed into a bathtub somewhere. And so far I haven't. So I am very much aware of his, how things went with him. I'm talking about the octopus in generalities. I'm talking about what was described by the mayor of New York City back in 1922, when he talked about this Rockefeller Standard Oil interest, this gigantic octopus with its sprawling tentacles into everything. So, yeah, I'm talking about that global octopus. And of course, it's not my symbology. I didn't come up with it. It wasn't my idea. But when you read about this, you find an animal like the octopus and eight tentacles, of course, and I break that down into eight chapters of the book, and you've got a creature that's extremely intelligent, can change colors, can change textures, can spray ink and get away, or it can stay and fight with a hidden beak. It's kind of a perfect representation of what we're going up against, these intergenerational families that have been running things. They're very dangerous. They stay in the shadows as long as they need to. They want to pretend like they don't exist. They want to blend into the background like an octopus does. They're very devious and smart, but they'll run and hide or stay and fight if they need to. So I thought the symbolism behind the octopus was great. And But yeah, that's sort of what we were talking about in that book. And one of the things that made the book different than most was that I brought in – the format is a little bit different because I brought in quotes from over 500 different people that had either a firsthand seat or some sort of interesting opinion on what they saw. So, of course, you've got Rockefellers and Rothschilds and the Bushes and the Clintons and all the regular cast of characters you would expect to be in there. But I've also got George Carlin and Bill Hicks and Joe Rogan and guys that are, you know, comedians or people that see things from a different angle, and they can sort of summarize what they're seeing in a different way. So it's a big book. It's 540 pages. It was the first book. It came out in 2017. But it's a surprisingly quick read because of the way the quotes are laid out. You get through all of this, and you know, people can deny that this stuff is happening, but then you read a Rockefeller quote where they're talking about what they plan to do, and it's like, hey man, I'm not the one speculating saying this. Like, they said it. Like, they didn't, not only they said it in their autobiography. Like, they didn't get, it's not like they got drunk. It's not like David Rockefeller got drunk at a bar and like told some guy, I want to take over the world. He like wrote it in his autobiography, and he's proud of it, you know. So part of this was like, I wanted to show the reader, I wanted to say, hey, look, listen to what these people are saying. Like, forget my opinion on it. You know, my opinion's in there, of course, but just listen to their words. They'll tell you what the plan is if you listen. And of course, it's not on the nightly news because they control the nightly news, so they're not going to broadcast this, but it's there. So I did the digging so that a lot of people wouldn't have to.
No, look, fair enough. And difficult job because, you know, quite frankly, even this week we saw a spurious quote from Voltaire utilized, you know, in the general sort of social media, which I found interesting. A lot of people quote Voltaire, and they don't understand this man philosophically at all. I don't know what to say. But it's interesting because there's been a lot of spurious quotation where, you know, for instance, where somebody talks about, you know, utilizing inflation and deflation as a weapon. The terminology didn't exist at the time that quotation was made, and it's very difficult to find a source for it. In other words, it really never happened. Different things have come down the pike like this over the years, and I would be a little bit nervous about taking on a quotation book because sourcing every single one of these things is hard.
It's tough. And listen, my philosophy, whether it has to do with quotations or content or my interpretation of it, I reserve the right to change my mind if I am presented with new information, better information that conflicts with what I previously thought. I always want to give myself the opportunity to get it right. Not necessarily be right, but get it right. You know, so if I come across something that I got wrong, be it in a book or a podcast or whatever, I check my ego at the door on that because in the interest of just trying to get the message correct, that's the important thing to do. So I fully expect that in the future, I'll have to make amendments to some of the books and things like that, or I'll have to at least acknowledge that, hey, I got this part wrong and everything. I'm going to get things wrong. That's fine. We're going to get some of the quotes wrong too. You know, you do the best you can, you find all this stuff, and then in the end, it's like, I think this one's right. And then if I had real questions, I'd throw it out. But yeah, it's a difficult thing because, you know, look, a lot of people don't want to go on the record when they're saying something as devious as their plans for taking over the world. But
right.
But from time to time, you catch these guys that are arrogance takes over. Where the brain stops, the arrogance takes over, and they start saying things that maybe they shouldn't be saying, and you catch them in an unusual moment. So, but in the end, it does paint a picture of a very devious plan.
Yeah, I need to interrupt you, though, because here's the thing. I'm glad to hear you say what you just said. There are too many people that I call it, and I know this isn't politically correct, but my show will do what I want. You know, they go home with the ugly chick after they've been drinking, and they don't want to admit that they went home with the ugly chick because they were drinking. And it's somebody who gets married to a philosophy or a theory. I really have to mention this when it comes to the JFK assassination because I've watched it happen many times, spent a lot of time in that community. Community. And the thing is that, you know, there are people that they get set on something and they do not want to surrender ownership because they might have made a mistake. I have a lot more respect for somebody who says, look, I did the best I could. I now have new information. And I've adjusted things just over the past couple of years where I thought I had a lock on information and new things came to light.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, you learn and you pick up something else, and that is, it is never set in stone as far as I'm concerned. Right. When it comes to independent, you know, producers of educational material, which is something that we actually are if we're taking it seriously. Now, it may be revisionist history. It may be the challenges of, I mean, I know they want to slap conspiracy theorists on people like you and me a lot. Yeah. But you know what? I know where that term came from. And what are you going to do?
Exactly.
It's the exploration. And the thing is, I'm willing to admit when, new information comes my way, you show me something different, sure. Something that I can, you know, verifiably weigh against what it was I saw before. Absolutely. I'm willing to adjust all the time.
Yeah.
But I never understood these guys who just clutch on to something.
It's an ego thing. And I mean, I think we have to recognize, look, we're going up against professional disinformation agencies that all they do is lie. They're very good at it. They're very sophisticated. They understand how human psychology works. I mean, they're the best. So if the fact that we figure anything out, frankly, is a bit of a miracle, but we have to recognize that these guys are good at what they do. We're trying to be as good, if not better. And sometimes we fall short. Now, does that discredit everything that we say? Hopefully not. But I think in some people's eyes, it's like, ah, you got that one thing wrong. So, you know, we're going to sink your whole ship. I don't know. I don't know if I want to, you know, be in an industry where we do that. I just say, look, let's put our heads together. I mean, I don't ever pretend to have this puzzle figured out. You know, we might have the edge pieces of this puzzle, but we're still working on the overall picture. And I need all the help I can get. I'll take it from the right people. You want to come and help me out? Great, because this is not a one man job. This is going to require all of us. So it's that exploration of the truth that you discover new things, new avenues. So it's been a journey for me. It's been, you know, I woke up to this stuff, I don't know, back in 2007, I had like the real awakening. I was awake to 9/11 and all that stuff way before that, but I started to have it. It became real to me when I went through the financial crash. I was living in Las Vegas, selling new homes, selling real estate there, when it went up and when it went down. And I saw the manipulation going on in the mortgage industry, and I saw that fraud. And I got a lot of my customers hurt by selling them houses that then dropped in price. And I got myself hurt too. I had two houses and lost them both and all that. So I was not immune to it. I was drinking my own Kool-Aid. But after that point, I decided, you know what? It's like three card Monty, you know, that game where you know it's a scam and they scam you. And I just said, just show me how it works. Just show me how the game works. I'm not going to play anymore. I just want to understand it. So I started to learn about money and the dollar and how that works. And that led me into down this financial rabbit hole. And that really blew. I read John Perkins' book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And I was like, whoa, this is a global thing. IMF, World Bank, who wants to read about that? Those are boring. But then you start to realize how important that is. And it's like, oh my God, I have to know about this. If I don't know about that, then I'm missing out on a huge piece of this picture. So that rabbit hole, you know, it connects to all the other rabbit holes too. So that's where I came from. So it's like, I'm relatively new to this, being what, 15 plus years in, relatively new. You know, there's guys that have been doing this their entire lives. So there's still, it'd be arrogant for me to think I've got it all figured out. There's still so much that I don't even know. I don't even know what I don't know at this point.
See, now that's interesting. Now you've led me into a direction I didn't even think I was going to go in with you at all, but I think it necessary now. And I'll share with you mine. I'll show you mine, so you'll show me yours.
Okay.
Okay. Look, I got into the JFK assassination when I was in high school still, and it was a curiosity that led me to, ready for this one, I wanted to disprove the conspiracy theory stuff and just be able to satisfactorily lay that out. Okay, and it was 1988. Okay. And I spent a long time and wound up doing very serious things. I started out just by reading books and then contacting people that I read about in the book just because I could, you know, stuff like that. And I wound up dealing with films, documents, everything later on. uncredited, never bothered. I didn't want to write a book. I didn't want to do a show. I just wanted to know.
Yeah.
So I lived through 9/11. I lived through all that stuff. And really, even though I was chasing down this very complex issue, I didn't feel as though the game was totally loaded. I mean, I always had this problem with authority, and I always had this problem with our government that was, you know, lying to me for a personal reason. Because, well, there's a whole thing with my father where they disappeared his military records and all that.
Whoa.
And anyways, so that's a, I'll tell you another time when we have more time.
Okay.
But the thing is, there was a reason why I didn't trust the government. There was a reason why I didn't trust the official story. That I grew up not trusting the authorities anyway. The cops, forget it. Nothing.
Yep.
But I still did not really get to that part of awake. 9/11, I'm in New Jersey. I wasn't too far away, and I didn't see it, and I still didn't see it. I came around to it, honestly, full on, like, no, everything is a loaded game in this casino. Okay, like, I knew how to play cards. I knew how to play blackjack. I understood the odds, but I didn't realize how exactly the house always wins, okay, until right about the same time as you. And I'm not sure why that was, because the financial crash, I had no stake, really. I had already been beaten up by plenty of things.
Right.
My own stakes. You know, I got out of work, and I was working for ExxonMobil at one point. I got out of doing that because I didn't feel like exploiting people. Okay, and I even made the moral compromise with I felt oil was destroying the world. But I could live with that. It was just punishing workers for no reason I couldn't do. So I got out of that. And I'll tell you, it took till about 2008 when I finally said, wait a minute here. Not only is, you know, the entire monetary system, which always seemed immoral, but what are you going to do? It's right. The only thing there is. Not only did that come to hit me, but, you know, I've been lied to about everything. It's not just the Kennedy assassination.
Right.
Everything. And I don't know what that moment was really that got it there, except that it just all clicked one day and I said, oh. This is not, you know, and I had listened to Bill Cooper when he was on shortwave radio, and I had listened to tapes of Mae Brussels as a kid, and I had, so I had been all exposed to that stuff and said, yeah, I'm still skeptical. All the way through until I'm about, let's see, 2008. Gee, let's see, I'm 49 today, so if we go back to 2008.
Yeah, you and I are the same age.
Yeah, so, yeah. I mean, I was born in 72, so 2008, I'm that old before I said, wait a minute, this is all a bunch of BS. This is all a loaded system. It's definitely, like Carlin said, you know, it's a big club. You ain't in it.
Yep.
You know, you mentioned Hicks, of course. He was right about a whole lot of things, too.
Yep.
I mean, not only were the comedians I loved right, but these conspiracy people that I actually set out at one point in my mind to discredit. Debunk completely. Yeah, they were all, and I had fallen on the conspiracy advocacy side of the Kennedy assassination many years before, but still was like, this is a bad time. This led to the Vietnam War. This was a manipulated situation, but I could not see that I never had a chance being born in 72. None of this was under my control. None of this was my game. I had no stake in the casino. Matter of fact, I didn't even have chips to play with. I am a chip.
Yeah. Maybe.
And I'm a small chip. And that's what I figured out in 2008. So I'm curious. Everybody else almost says, I've got this one moment. Not just this, you know, turning. And it obviously took me, you know, I'm an idiot. It took me 30 years. But somebody else usually says, you know what? It's this one thing. I'm there.
Yeah.
What was it for you?
March 2007. I was going on a trip. A buddy of mine says to me, I've got a book for you. I think you'll like it. And it's Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins. Now, I was on a scuba diving trip, and I was reading this book on the plane on the way there and then, you know, on the boat. And I remember thinking, when I was underwater, thinking, well, my dive's almost over, but at least I get to go up and start reading more of the book. I was so interested in it. And what it did, so the point about the book that really got me, was that John Perkins worked for a company called Maine. That's like a Halliburton, multinational engineering firm. And his job they jokingly called him an economic hitman. His job is that he would approach countries, presidents of countries, and say, you have the great topography here for a hydroelectric power plant. Tell you what, my company can build it. It'll be great. It'll cost this much money. It'll generate this much revenue for you. You'll have electricity. Your people will learn to read. We'll put a little money in your pocket. We'll put it in a Cayman Islands bank account or whatever. But it's all going to pencil out. It's going to be great. And I got the money lined up for you by the IMF and World Bank. They said that you're already pre-approved, you know. Now, mind you, I'm reading this working in real estate, right, talking about pre-approvals and mortgages and all this stuff, right? So then they build the hydroelectric power plant. It starts generating revenue, but nowhere near what it was supposed to, because it was never supposed to generate the amount of revenue that they said it would. They fall behind in their payments. And then, like any good loan shark, the IMF and World Bank and John Perkins say, hey, listen, man. Hey, listen, Ecuador. You owe us a lot of money. But I think we can work something out. Why don't you vote our way in a UN resolution, or you privatize your lumber industry and let our buddies at Goldman Sachs buy it, or you let us put a U.S. military base, some shitty deal that they don't want, right? And they get strong-armed into it. And I'm reading this, and I'm going, okay, so they loan imaginary money and take back tangible assets. And then I'm going, wait a second, I'm doing this, I'm a part of this on a smaller scale in Las Vegas. Real estate's booming, right? It's 2007. This is like the height of the market. There's guys coming in trying to buy houses from me that make $10 an hour, fill out the mortgage application. I'm just going, there's no way. Fax it over to my mortgage company, get a call 10 minutes later saying, we're good. We're good to go. And I'm going, this is going to be a catastrophe for this guy, right? But hey, I'm approved, right? He makes 10 bucks an hour, but he's approved, and he doesn't, you know, I must be good for it. If the bank said I'm good for it, then I guess I'm good for it. And he buys the house. And then the prices drop. And then the banks take back tangible assets in exchange for this fake money. And I go, I'm part of this. I'm part of a smaller version of this big scam. And it opened my eyes to it. And that was a moment after reading that book. It just changed my life, you know? I mean, it just changed the way I saw everything. And then the Wall Street crash, and I thought, well, and then they said, well, listen, if we don't get $700 billion by Monday, you know, there's going to be martial law. And it's like, these guys are gangsters. This is, you know, so it all started to make sense. And of course, it's incremental, so it builds upon itself. And so the more you have to have an understanding of sort of the base layer, and then more gets explained to you, and that just did it for me. And after that, I wanted no part of that system. I didn't want to be a contributing factor to some guy losing his house, you know. And like I said, I lost my houses too. I didn't come out of this. I wasn't like the guy going, I got swindled these people. Like, I got wiped out too. But I was determined to never have, you know, to never fall for that carnival game again. And I wanted to understand the game so that I could see how it was played. And that just leads you down a rabbit hole. And ironically, you know, you start reading about the Federal Reserve and central banking and all these things I take an interest in now that I would have never in a million years had any interest in. And then I'm waiting for my airplane. I'm waiting for a plane in Mexico City. I'm going to Acapulco, to Anarcapulco, to speak at the largest anarchist convention. And who's sitting next to me waiting to get on the plane? G. Edward Griffin. God, this guy wrote The Creature from Jekyll Island about the Federal Reserve. I said, I've got questions. You know, so this poor guy, he's the sweetest guy in the world. I got to know him after that, but he's the sweetest guy in the world. I just talked his ear off for 2 hours asking him a million questions about this because – yeah. Now all of a sudden I want to know about central banking. I would have never thought that. So the getting and taking an interest in these sorts of topics can lead you into avenues that you might never have even thought were interesting.
See, now it's funny because I understood the street level criminal. I grew up in that. That was like my childhood. I understood how that worked. That made sense. Matter of fact, I always thought them to be fairly honorable people getting a bad rap.
Yeah.
You know, truth. I grew up around bikers and mafia guys and just average.
I never had a problem with the mafia. I mean, I never interacted with them, but they seemed like, you don't bother me, we won't bother you, don't step on their toes, they won't mess with you.
Unless you're coming to intentionally do business with them, then you have problems.
Right.
If you leave them alone, they leave you alone. As a matter of fact, your neighborhood's safe, you know?
Right.
I mean, so simple. Nobody is going to go, you know, spray painting anything anywhere. You know, just saying. Okay. And I understood all that, and that all made sense, and I felt like, well, you know, this is just something outside of the system. I still failed to recognize that the system is the much more sophisticated gangster because, you know, the Italian businessman, he may have a better suit on, but he's not making the bank that these guys are making. He's not, you know, they say, oh, look at this guy. He controlled this in the tri-state area. It's nothing. Compared to, you know, we control all of the gas. We right. control all of the electricity. We control all of your food. No, it's a whole other game. Okay.
Right.
And it's, the principles do apply, except one thing. You pay protection money to an Italian businessman, your shop might not burn down. You pay it to these other criminals, you got no guarantees of anything.
Right.
So, good luck.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The president of the Federal Reserve New York branch is looking at Michael Francesi going, yeah, it's all right. What you, you're running gasoline scams.
Mm-hmm.
I'll show you real scams. You want to talk about real money? We'll show you what the Fed's doing. We'll show you the scams we're running. You guys have no idea how big this can be, you know? So, like, yeah, the governments are they're the biggest gangsters. And once I recalibrated my brain and came to understand that and set that as the default, things started to make a whole lot more sense. And I did that same thing with regard to my relationship with the mainstream media. I had always, wrongfully, of course, but I had no reason as a kid to assume that they were lying to me. I didn't know about the CIA infiltration as a kid. I didn't know anything about that. I might think that they might get the stories wrong from time to time, but I didn't think they were intentionally trying to do it. And because there were multiple networks, my assumption was they're all equally trying to get the right, you know, the best angle of the story. So they're all in competition with each other.
At least for the sake of competition. Right. Right.
Right. Right.
Okay. Yeah.
I then had to, once I realized what the mainstream media was and that they weren't really in competition with each other, they're all colluding and it's all a gigantic agenda to sort of put out a message, a coordinated message. Then I set my default mechanism to, I don't trust anything these people say unless you blow me away with some story, or maybe I believe you with the weather or sports, but not the headlines, not what's, or, you know, maybe cop rescues kitten from a tree, but not what's going on in Syria. I don't believe anything.
Quick side question. From 2007, how long did it take you to get to Edward Bernays?
About 5 years.
Oh, okay. No,
yeah.
Just curious.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I had a job where I wound up in a job where I had to physically be there, but there wasn't much going on. And so I watched YouTube videos and read books and did as much as I could. And eventually it kind of gets you to Edward Bernays. So the order in which I got to these people was very haphazard. There's not like one straight line. I kind of jumped all over the place. It might even have been like as like simple as YouTube's algorithm putting videos in front of me and me going, yes, that's what I want to watch. I didn't even know I wanted to watch that.
Sorry, I keep chuckling because here's the thing. You know what happened to me in 2007-08 is what? That I ended up on a dead end kind of job on an overnight where, yes, indeed, there wasn't much to do. And, so I found these little podcasts and I started finding books and I started listening to books and trying to just keep myself awake. Yeah. On overnight shifts where, yep. Yeah, and I think that's one of the biggest mistakes they ever made is giving people like us dead-end jobs because it's like, well, let me try and keep myself occupied, and then you get to sticking an earphone in and you're reading a book in between your responsibilities, and all of a sudden a whole education emerges.
And so for those of you that are listening to this, and you've been listening to Chuck for years and years, and you're doing this because you're in a dead-end job, just understand that in 10 years or 15 years or so, you may very well be the one doing the broadcast.
It's so funny because that's exactly what happened. I mean, I started bothering these guys, James Corbett, Jack Blood, Clyde Lewis. I started bothering them and telling them, you need to do better research on this and that, especially the Kennedy thing. Here's what you need to know. I started sending them stuff, and all of them basically universally came back at me after a couple of years of putting up with me. And James Corbett had me on his show as a guest, though. And then the other guys, they turned around and just basically started saying, you know, why don't you just do your own show? which
– there you go.
Thus the podcast was born. And then I just went live with it in 2014 for the first time. But it was just – I had recorded stuff before that. But the thing is, though, it was like, why don't you just do it yourself if you know how to do this? And, be the media.
Yeah,
you don't like what you got? Be the media.
Be the media. And how funny is this, Chuck, that it's gone from, million-dollar sound stages with multi-million-dollar anchors. But the information is just poisoned. And so many people recognize what you and I can do from our own little home studios has more nutritional value to that information than the junk food that the mainstream media with their multi-million dollar sets and ad campaigns and people can serve out. Nobody's watching it. They don't care anymore. Tim Pool is kicking CNN's ass. Tim Pool is. Joe Rogan, he's trouncing these people. There's a desire for good information, and they don't care about, the people don't care about the necessarily like the overproduction value and the this and the that. And God, even that stuff, like you said, you mentioned Edward Bernays. I mean, every time I see the mainstream media nightly news, I just keep getting these like, I feel like Bernays would be sitting back behind there going, you've got to use the right this tone, this right key. It's got to be C, C. That connects with their brains, it's just so gross and so like manufactured. And it just seems like processed junk food for your brain. And the sooner we get people out of that, the better off we're going to be. And it's you'll never know. You'll never know how many people you reached and how many people that was the last thing they needed for them to go, I get it now. How do you quantify or measure your reach over these years? What, 7 years of doing eight years, coming up on 8 years of doing this?
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to say.
You'll never know, man. How do you know? You just mentioned Bill Cooper and Mabe Russell, and it's like, Their words mattered, their information was really great. And that it takes like repetition. It takes hearing this stuff from a bunch of different people. And for you to be one of the voices that gets somebody over the hill, man, that's a cool position to be in.
Listen, I'm pleased with whoever I reach. That's the thing. I don't care. I got to tell you, I'm noticing strange trends, though. You bring up Tim Pool. Let's get weird. Tim Pool is okay. I expect him to do that, and that's great. I like him. I'm not a big fan of Rogan. But anyway, put that aside. he's not that funny. I don't know. It just anyway. The weirdest thing that I've taken note of lately is a guy that I would have never taken seriously, nor did I think was even talented, but sits down at a table now with 4 million subscribers, and that's Russell Brand, who is making sense. Have you checked that out? I'm like, why did I not expect this guy to come forward and be logical, sensible, doing things that I would sign off on? Where did this happen? I remember him being a goofball as an actor and not very good. But now I see him doing this thing where he's just like, hello, you're my 4 million subscribers. Let's talk about what's what. And he lays out some good information. It's just him at a desk.
He's a smart guy. And I think the biggest fear with him is that secret compromised, you know, he somehow is in this position because he's allowed to be. And so I always have to keep that in the back of my mind and keep an eye on it. But I like Russell Brand. I saw him do stand-up, actually, back in 2011 when I was living in Vegas. I saw him. He's great. You could tell he just ad-libbed the whole thing, which I thought was crazy, but also showed like a level of talent. But I've been, you know, interested, you know, known who he was, thought he always said good things. Actually quoted him in my Octopus book. He's in there. I quoted him and he was at an event for a fashion event. And he was sitting with Noel Gallagher and he won an award. And he went up there and gave what I described as the greatest acceptance speech in the history of award shows, which is where he thanked Hugo. He said it was amazing that Hugo Boss won this award, and he said that it was, you know, that let's not forget that they designed the uniforms for the Nazis. Mm-hmm. And he said this in front of like a mortified group of pretentious assholes at this awards banquet. Wow. He's like, but they did look fantastic as they were executing people for their religious beliefs and their sexuality and their race and everything. And he was banned from the event forever. So was Noel. They were literally thrown out of it. So I know he has a tendency to kind of say what he thinks. And so I've got him in my Octopus book doing that, man. So I'm with you. I think he's insightful and he's intelligent and he's been through some stuff. And I wouldn't be surprised if his background is, I don't know, if he's got ties to intelligence agencies in the family somewhere. I wouldn't be the slightest bit surprised, but he's talking about some important things. I agree.
No, it's interesting. Look, I say maintain that skepticism with everybody.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Because I got my thoughts on some of the more popular, let's call them alternative media people out there, and why it is that they're allowed to continue doing what they're doing. I got lots of thoughts. I'm not going to go there right now because I don't have that much more time with you. But I'm just saying it's a weird situation, though, where you're starting to see people question things that I don't think they would have in the past. You're starting to see some pretty remarkable shifts. And at the same time, I can't be anything but have a little bit of caution. You know, there always has to be caution with my optimism. Yep. Because it's not possible for me to think that one day this will just, you know, evaporate. You know, it is as simple as that, by the way. If a significant minority pushes back hard enough on this, it will. They'll have to change it just in an effort to maintain the control. But it doesn't ever seem to get to that, you know, tipping point. And again, I've observed this many different ways and kind of not necessarily on the advocacy side of it at one point, but still taking it in. I mean, I'm like I said, you know, if I knew adults that were getting the World Watchers cassettes from Mae Brussels, and then I was, you know, tuning around shortwave radio getting Bill Cooper, and then I obviously caught good God, the guy who was not before George Norrie, Art Bell,
yeah.
Okay, and the various people that came into New York, I mean, you know, there's tons and tons of individuals. And by the way, I love talk radio, always have, even the weird stuff, which has nothing to do with anything, that's just a strange theater of the mind kind of experiment. You know, the strangeness of phone callers who call in incoherent is entertaining to me, interesting, and evocative. So it's all a very, very, very serious art form in my mind, whether it's comedy or not. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's a lot of ways to look at this, but even with all of that in hand, it's still a struggle. Of course, today we're dealing with, you know, the internet age, where on the one hand, it's a lot easier to reach an audience, but we're also restricted more. You know, you're getting choked out on YouTube and Google, but new little platforms pop up. You try those. You have to have your own website. Maybe they're going to make that more difficult soon. You know, it's a melee that is going on, and the progression, it's going to keep pushing. But how much optimism do you have for, like, because I always hear people either come down on one side or the other, where it's like, I feel like it's going to do no good anyway, but I got to do it. Or, you know what? I know that we're just about at that tipping point. And I heard people at that tipping point in the early 2000s who are gone now, you know, who thought that we were just months away from the big thing. New people that got into it a couple of years ago thinking that, I don't want to go into this discussion, but thinking that Trump was the new alternative.
Right.
Anyway. The thing about it is, see, notice I shut that conversation. I don't even want to go.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that they got all excited, like things are going to change. Things are going to change now.
Right.
And, you know, Occupy and the big 9/11 rallies that happened in New York and the conventions that have now been all, you know, shut down due to COVID, but that were like exploding at one point. All of this stuff and people go, nope, it's going to happen right now, very soon. I can never get on board with either side, either one of those two camps, because it's always like, listen, man, this is going to be a process. we're going to push and we're going to get shoved and we're going to have to keep marshaling forward as best we can, but have patience always. Where do you come down on that sort of like attitude about what can be done? The Great Awakening, getting people, now I don't want to use the term woke, but getting
people. Yeah, I know what you're saying. I know
to be aware, like, for God's sake.
Awareness, yeah. Of this. I read an article in Zero Hedge by Brandon Smith a couple days ago, and it was talking about, it was reminding the reader that this globalist group, this Davos World Economic Forum, Rockefeller, you know, that group, they are not as omnipotent as they would like you to believe. They don't plan 10 steps ahead. But if they did, all it takes is a mistake in step two to screw up everything else that comes after that, and that becomes a catastrophic waste of time and energy for them. So he said, let's remember that they're not as organized as they would like us to believe. Their narratives are very flimsy and they fall apart. The people that they have representing them, like the Trudeaus and the Jacinda Ardens and Scott Morrisons and all these people that you see, are fragile, weak, neurotic, compromised individuals that are pathological liars. And more people are starting to recognize that. So he was very optimistic in his article, and I share some of that optimism. I'll tell you where I'm the most optimistic, though, because, you know, we've talked tonight about JFK, 9/11, and COVID. Mm-hmm. And one of the common denominators between all of them is that the media drove the getaway car on all those narratives. If it wasn't for them,
right on,
we would have a totally different view of this. And what's happening right now that is giving me a little bit of hope and optimism is that the view of the common person towards the mainstream media is turning. They're starting to recognize that these people do not represent them and that they're not being completely honest with them. Now, to us, that's like you want to shake people and just go, what took you so long? Mm-hmm. But whatever. You know, we all wake up on our own little time. And for some people, you know, 9/11 jolted them. And maybe there's a new generation, COVID and the lies and the dishonesty from the media, and they keep getting caught, and then CNN with all their pedophile, you know, and all this stuff. It just so suddenly dawned on a huge generation that the media can't be trusted. Now that gives me hope, because if that is really happening, then that makes everything increasingly more difficult for these people. So they have to censor, because their message isn't getting out anymore. So their message isn't being listened to. Other people's are, so they're trying to censor. That's actually a good sign. It means that we're having an impact. It means that they're freaking out, that things are not going according to plan. So I'm incredibly optimistic about things. I'm not oblivious. I understand what we're up against. These people are psychopaths of the highest order, and their technocratic partnership is truly concerning to me. but I also don't want to make them godlike, because I don't want us to feel that what's the point of fighting this? Mm-hmm. The point is, as Chris Hedges says, I don't fight fascists to expecting to win. I fight fascists because they're fascists. You know, so it's like you fight these people because they're monsters. You know, so you stand up for yourself now. So I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic because because the media is exposing themselves, and it's glorious to see because they're a bunch of scumbags.
Listen, I can't argue with a single thing you just said. I do have a curiosity before we run out of time, though. But, you know, you and I, maybe, I don't know, some people pick fake names, but you and I might share a name, although you went in the Charlie direction, which I don't like. And
all my guy friends call me Chuck, though. They can't call me Charlie. It's too weird for them.
Isn't it? Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
I'm Chuck with all my friends.
Fair enough. You know, and I don't want to repeat all the names that people call me, but, you know, they called me Charlie as a kid, and I just couldn't
hang. Do it.
Yeah, it just didn't work. I'm clearly a Chuck.
So, yeah, you are.
So, I mean, it's just all there is to it. But anyway. Look, enough jokes aside, and all that, and I appreciate you having patience with me, because what did I do? I kind of started out mentioning that your head looked shiny, and
it is shiny though.
So, you know, listen, I appreciate your good nature, your good humor, the fact that you're on my side.
I'm on your side, man.
Again, you and I could disagree maybe on some stuff. Who knows?
Sure.
But the point is that I know that. Effectively, we're on the same team, and it's absolutely a great thing to meet anybody who is, for sure. And the fact that you're kind of in the, you know, ripple effect universe over there is another great thing. I love the titles and the attitude that you put forth about your books. So do us a favor. And, I know that I've given a link before for the Union of the Unwanted, but, tell us where people could find, you know, just your work. First of all, I mean, I hate sending people over to Amazon. I'm sure your books are there, but.
Well, I'll tell you what. Yes, they are, but there's a workaround. So my website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com, I can there's a option for people to pay to donate for the book. Donate $10, I'll send you a PDF and EPUB version of the new book, Hypocrisy. Donate $15 or more, I'll send you the Octopus book with it in digital format on those. Paperback stuff, I can't do much about it because they get printed from Amazon, but all the books are there if you need that in paperback. The podcast is Macroaggressions. It's out wherever in audio format everywhere. It's video format, band.video, Iconic, Rockfin, Odyssey, YouTube, and on Twitter, I'm at Macroaggression, and I just sit there and throw rocks at all these weirdos.
Nice. Rumble. So look, the final thing to cover just before we close out the hour, which we started a little late, so if you don't mind, I'll just take a couple of minutes with you. Yep. Macroaggression.
Yes.
I gotta tell you, I see the humor and I see the necessity in it. And I wish I had thought of it.
I just had, you know, I was reading something and it was talking about this person at this university. The student was all up in arms because this other student had committed a microaggression against him. And I was like, you know what, man, I got something for you. I've got an aggression. I've got a macroaggression for you, you know? And I started thinking, well, I'm going to call it that. And then, and it just kind of stuck. So that's where it comes from.
You and I just shared in a couple of microaggressions earlier. You know, I made ethnic comments. Oh, wow. We actually, we were otherizing Ricky's ethnic background by describing that he was Portuguese. So therefore we were making a generalization. Yes. To create are you exhausted yet? I am. Screw that. Look, you want aggression? I'll show you aggression.
Exactly. And by the way, Ricky will be the first to say, I'm Portuguese. I talk a lot. That can't help it.
You know, it's people make jokes all the time, and I'm like, yeah, that's about it. I don't care, by the way. Blind jokes, Italian jokes, bring them on. By the way, I'm half Irish. Hit that side if you can. Whatever. You know, drunk, mobster, crook, criminal. I am from Jersey, so whatever. And there's a whole box load of jokes there.
That's I think that we everybody needs to lighten up. This whole life that we're living is we got enough serious stuff going on. If we can't bust each other's balls, like, my goodness, you know, that needs to come back. The cancel culture is dumb. Everybody agrees. It's back to calling your buddy's, you know, retard if he's doing something stupid, you know.
See, this right here, it's not even about, you know, the John Perkins book, which I got a copy on the shelf over there. Of course, it's not about that. It's not about all. I'll tell you what, we'd easily be able to join a brotherhood right now just based on the fact that we believe that busting each other's balls is an absolutely God-given right.
There's something about it. It brings you it kind of deepens the bond a little bit. You know, you almost feel like if someone isn't busting your balls, maybe they don't care about you, you know, but at least with my guy friends, we've always done it. We did it from a good place. It's just a sign of affection. So
you got it.
We love it. And we're, you know, I don't want anyone to be super sensitive about this stuff. I try to make my books as funny as I can. So people, I've got actually my hypocrisy book is double sectioned. One is in political science and one is in comedy. You know, so there's as much humor in there, not because I'm funny, but because the truth is so preposterous that it just kind of makes you laugh. So I think people would be surprised at the amount of humor in these books and the books I've written that talk about really serious topics.
No surprise whatsoever that you and I could be funny guys. I mean, I know looks aren't everything, but you know, we're here and that's the way it goes. That was corny, but it fits. Anyways, Charlie Robinson, again, check out his work. Go listen to The Union of the Unwanted. I think I got that title exactly correct. But if not, I'm going to give you guys links. I'm going to have to give you the Amazon link if you want a physical book. But go to his website and go get it, because if you want the digital version, wouldn't you rather just pay him directly? I would. I would rather do that. No more money for Bezos. Screw him. And I'm not busting his balls. Anyway, thanks, Charlie Robinson.
Thanks, Chuck.
Stick around in the next hour. Geez, we're going to talk to Roberta Glass. You won't want to miss it. The Ocelli Effect continues after this.
This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and you're listening to The Ocelli Effect at Ocelli.com.
Do you like history? Real history that you were never taught in schools? Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia, by author Mike Swanson, with new documentation never seen before that'll open your eyes to events that led up to this. Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia, 1945 through 1961. Get your copy today at Amazon.com. Why? The Vietnam War, by author Mike Swanson.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Go there now.
Go there now.
Go there now.
In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks, by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock.
For more information, go to Larry-Hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at Amazon.com in digital or physical form.
Uncle, do you remember that time when the year 2012 was going to create the apocalypse, end of the world?
Right. And I thought it would come to the end.
Did it ever end up that way?
No.
Yeah.
Like we say, the only way it will end is when he is ready for
That's
it
right.
to end. That's how it ends.
So if you want the real truth about 2012, you better listen to the Ocelli.com radio network.
Radio podcast. .com.
Yeah, forget it's John Cusack.
John Cusack
doesn't know what he's talking about.
Know what he's talking actually about. Correct.
But we here at the Ocelli Radio Network sure do.
Do you sure understand and understand where it's actually coming from?
Ocelli.com.
Okay, sir, now we will begin to proceed to obtain your IQ and aptitude tests.
You got hepatitis. Oh.
Second hour of the Ocelli Effect begins now here at Ocelli.com and our affiliates, so on and so forth, that carry us live. But majority of you catch the podcast via your final slab of choice, your applicable application, your podcatcher du jour. So here we are, Wednesday, and Nature Boy's been producing the Wednesdays, bringing on some of the best people. Now, it's been a few years that I have listened to the podcast of the guest I have in this hour, but I never could figure out how to get her on the show. Now, William Ramsey is familiar with her, and I'm familiar with William Ramsey. So, you know, I almost wanted to ask him if he could help me get her on the show. Turns out Nature Boy did it for me, though, and I'm really happy to have Roberta Glass with us. And, man, this is very cool. I appreciate you just right out of the gate. I want to tell you a little bit of fandom.
Okay. Yeah,
but, you know, very cool stuff you do. True crime, okay, which is different from me for sure, you know, because I go all over the place. And sometimes true crime, yes, but, you know, I'm more about political conspiracies, research on certain things, news, you know, cultural phenomena, stuff like this. But, well, I'm glad to have you along. And true crime is one of those passions that usually I keep to myself, actually. but here we go. And, you know, introduce yourself because you haven't been on the show before. I really would appreciate it if you kind of said, hey, look, I'm Roberta Glass, and I know you've heard of me. But if you haven't, here's what you would have to know.
Okay, I'm Roberta Glass. I am a court-going junkie, a true crime podcaster. I attended the NXIVM trial. I just finished covering the Ghislaine Maxwell trial. I went to that. And I'm looking like I'm going to go to Sarah Palin's trial tomorrow. Which is coincidentally, that's how I'm spending my birthday. I'm going to the Sarah Palin trial. And I talk about true crime, but I'm very interested in innocence fraud and talking about true crime. Really, true crime, the facts, the case as it was tried in court, and how that is spun into true crime entertainment and media. And what I mean by innocence fraud is making someone who is incredibly guilty look innocent for profit. And that is what I consider the biggest fraud in America right now. And it's the least talked about fraud. But all over the country, especially in blue cities, we are paying out guilty people millions of dollars for their completely rightful conviction. And it's just a money machine. And it started out pretty much, I would say, pushed by the left, but the Republicans are now embracing it universally, and nobody can resist the money that it's producing. And it's not just producing in the judgments, in the civil judgments, it's also in the money that it's making for Netflix, HBO, series like Making a Murderer, and the West Memphis 3, the whole Paradise Lost series, and also in podcasts like Serial with Adnan Syed. All three, Stephen Avery, Adnan Syed, and the West Memphis 3, all people rightfully convicted and are incredibly guilty.
So. Okay. Well, you see, now you and I might see things a little differently. And I'm not on the left, by the by. It's just that I've seen people ground up by the system who just simply couldn't defend themselves way too many times. And I've seen it on small issues way too many times personally, right? And quite often, it is absolutely horrendous. It seems to me as though if you are, you know, among the worst criminals, you'll figure out a way to get away with it. But quite honestly, if you're poor, a lot of times you get, you know, you just get hammered by the system. And look, in the case of Avery, I mean, I don't even know where to begin with that mess. You know, that is just adequate. I mean, first of all, he's not a poor guy. That's a delusion that Netflix sold you. And secondly, the whole thing is totally bizarre. I do feel bad for his nephew because I'm not sure that his nephew was really involved.
Oh, he's very involved. What they did in that series is is they cut up his confession. So it looks like something happened that really didn't. You have to read his entire confession to really understand how that happened. But you're right in some ways in that, because what happened was is he really became a sacrifice for Avery, the whole family. The prosecutor and the state wanted to make a deal with him, and the family wouldn't let him because for Dassey to admit, that's the nephew, to admit guilt, it would be to admit guilt for Stephen. And so he was sacrificed. They all told him to go to trial, and he was really a sacrifice for Stephen Avery. And that's how that happened. I've done two interviews with Ken Kratz, the prosecutor, and he has a lot more sympathy for Dassey than I do, because Dassey came, I mean, if you believe his confession, which I do, he came into this seeing Teresa Halbach tied up, about to be raped. I don't think he knew at that point she was going to be murdered. She's begging for help. As a woman, that's my nightmare. And if you finally someone comes to the door and you think, and you're begging this person for help, and instead they join in. So that's where I don't have a lot of that's where my compassion ends for him.
Oh, look. And yeah. I told you, I don't know where to begin sorting out that mess.
They're innocent. You're talking about I separate. This is the Innocence Project is not interested in the. I'm not talking about the drug war, the war on drugs. I am talking about rapists and murderers. And the Innocence Project seems to want to represent the scariest, most guilty clients they can find. I don't understand it. It's one person, and I go through these transcripts. It's one guiltier person than the next. I am not saying that wrongful convictions don't happen. They happen. But what they do is exploit our compassion for people who were wrongfully convicted and funnel it onto people who are really guilty. For example, let's talk about Purvis Payne, because this just actually is newsworthy. He was a guy on death row. He raped a mother, killed her 2-year-old. This is Charisse Christopher was her name. Killed her 2-year-old daughter, Lacey. Almost murdered her 3.5-year-old son, Nicholas. He held his intestines all the way to the hospital, miraculously lived. He was ID'd by the neighbors. He was seen. He left his fingerprints, blood, and on beer cans all over the apartment. He was seen fleeing the scene, caught by a cop, assaulted the cop, covered in blood, hid, finally was found in, like, you know, hiding. Brought in, okay? That's their client. That's the person that they're claiming is innocent. They test the knife, okay, the DNA on the knife.
Mm-hmm.
It comes back with his DNA on it. Does the Innocence Project walk away from their client and say, I'm sorry, we can't help you? No. They found some incomplete DNA, and the press runs with the story that he's innocent because of this incomplete DNA, which means incomplete DNA, just to educate your audience, will never be matched. It's incomplete. So that would be definition. From anything, right?
By
so
definition.
DNA is the most exploitable kind of evidence. Say, like, you go to a bank, you leave a hair, you leave a, you know, it gets robbed that day. You know, there's all sorts of explanations for DNA, and they like to exploit it. So this guy, they said, now they got him off death row recently. I don't know where. However you feel about the death penalty, you should be concerned. Because he's off death row, and now he's eligible for parole in 5 years, this guy. They say his IQ is too low, not to kill. He probably raped Charisse Christopher because her tampon was found, pulled out of her. So I don't know. He wasn't too dumb to do that crime, but he's now too dumb to execute. And now he's eligible for parole. So, right. You know, they say, I mean, it's sort of like an anti-death penalty movement on one hand, but they do it. I don't mind people being against the death penalty, but don't tell me these people are innocent. You know, don't go this way. And you have people Sister Helen Prejean out there, just a nun lying about these cases. I mean, I feel like I'm in bizarro world.
See, now I understand that when you're looking at certain cases, right? On the other hand, and look, I'm always the let's examine this from as many angles as possible, right? In the case with Dassey there, the one problem I had, and I don't know if I've had access to this information really, is that based on the description that he gives, they don't find the evidence for what he describes. Something is wrong with the story. Now, I'm not saying that he's innocent. But what I'm saying is that somebody didn't tie this down to why there's something with this story. And let's put that aside, because, again, it's one of those things that I have no reason to disagree with you about Avery and Dassey, honestly. But when you look at stuff like – I don't know what your view is. I should know this, but I don't. What's your view is on the kids in Central Park? Or
very guilty.
You think that they're guilty?
I spent 2 months. Part of their deal, and I've talked about this with William Ramsey. Part of the deal with the Central Park Five is when they got out, they agreed to put up all the transcripts. Every part of their case is up, and it's up on like NewYorkCity.gov, and anyone listening can go through. Oh, it's amazing! And they fought to put a lot of that stuff up, which should raise your eyebrow. Why would they fight to not, if this was such a terrible conviction, why they would fight to take, I know now you're thinking, God, why did I have Roberto on? But why they fought? And I spent 2 months, the most disturbing months of my life, going through, there's two trials, each one of those trials, reading the transcript, and it's very disturbing. Watching the confessions, and I encourage and this is how they get away with it, because, you know, these things sound good on the surface. you know, on like a, oh no, like it happened like this. Racism caused it. But then when you get into the details, you know, it's very hard to put racism up on trial. You know what I'm saying? It's like no. The details of it are the devil's in the details. The truth is in the details of all these stories. And the Central Park Five, and even they can't get their story straight years later. They're going through the park, and it wasn't just that they were assaulting different people going through the park, were calling them in to the police, saying these bunch of kids are doing this. And it was a gang rape, just like none of the people that looked at Tricia Mailey, the doctors, agree. There's no expert you can find who said one person did it alone. And if you listen to Mateus Reyes' confession, it makes no sense. Yes, I think he was a part of it, but so were all the other people who were. And the reason why I think, and this is another very kind of odd, Yusuf Salam, who's running for office in New York now, got a Lifetime Achievement Award from Obama is because he's the only one whose mother refused to let him be questioned. So there's a lot more evidence against the other kids. Do you know what I mean? And they were kids at the time, but they're adults now. So that's why I think he's much more celebrated. He's also much more accomplished than the other four.
No, okay, fair enough. Look, you may have a great deal more knowledge on the case than I do, but it looks to me like you don't have, they didn't have a solid case against all of them, is the only thing that I could determine from
it. Two juries convicted them and get 12 people to agree on anything. I'm not saying a jury never gets it wrong. I'm just saying same case, two juries. There's a lot of evidence against them. It was a political decision. They wanted $250 million. They didn't get it. But that's what they wanted. And that's what this thing, and de Blasio agreed to do it so he'd get elected. This is what's going on. I mean, I find it so disturbing. What happened to Tricia Mailey is horrendous. And it would be horrendous if the Central Park Five were locked up for what they did their time. They were out. It was a fait accompli. And it was a political decision to sort of vacate their conviction after they all had done their time.
Okay. Well, in that case, I'll ask you about the last bunch of things that I wanted to.
I'm sorry. And now everybody's turned off their radio. I'm like, God, what am I listening to? No, actually, Chuck, I have a question for you, actually.
Sure.
So you're a JFK researcher, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How do you do it? Because you know, I love Rob Clark's podcast. That's probably one of my favorite podcasts.
The Lone Gunman, Rob. Yeah.
Oh, man, I love that. I love Rob Clark. I love that podcast. But I don't know how he and you, and I've listened to you some of your JFK stuff, I don't know how you do it. You have more fraudsters in that community, the JFK research community. I'm thinking I relate it to the innocence fraud community. But you got, now I'm freaking forgetting her name, Judith Barry Baker, going around saying she had an affair with Oswald, selling a billion books, getting rich on it. Nobody calls her out. She gives these interviews.
Except me.
That was a saloon.
Except me. You understand?
I just don't know how you do it, like research, and it just gets more complicated and complicated. Who's a fraud? Who's not a fraud? It's so I don't know how you have the fortitude without getting frustrated. How do you do it without getting so frustrated?
You do get frustrated. And it is a methodical, messy process that I would never suggest to another human being. Because, you know, if you think court cases are rough, yeah, try this.
Tried a little bit. I got frustrated. I got out of it really quick.
No,
I'm getting nowhere. I'm getting nowhere. Like half everything's redacted. You don't know what you're looking at. I thought, right. Oh, wasn't it 2017 when all that stuff came out, was released?
Okay.
Is that right? When was that?
In 2017, the work of the Assassination Records Review Board was supposed to be released. The stuff that they said they needed 25 more years before they could release. And, you know, and just like as I predicted, because everybody went, no, Trump's going to release it all. I said, oh, just watch and see. I was like the only guy standing there going, they're going to drop a little bit of stuff and then they're going to keep withholding. And they did. And then somebody, you know, was starting to tell me Biden's coming in. He's going to. I said, watch and learn. Because no, and still,
like, just nobody can live and release these documents. I mean, we still don't have Oswald's tax records out. They still haven't been released. No,
they are still not released in full. No,
I mean,
we
it's
have
like a never ending thing.
Yes,
I love it. I love listening to it, but Lord, does
it is without a doubt.
I just don't know how you do it.
It. I'll tell you what it is. Is that you? Okay, I have a personal motivation. Okay, and it's not because I'm a big fan of Kennedy or anything like that. Here's what my personal motivation is. Kennedy was going to pull us out of Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's what my personal motivation is. It is the thing that destroyed my father. And sorry. You owe me an explanation, not you. Mm-hmm. This government owes me an explanation. There needs to be a truth seen here. Because if he was killed precisely so that we could engage in that ridiculousness in Vietnam, then you know what? There's a lot of people that need to answer for 2 million dead Vietnamese, 80,000 dead Americans, and 1 million men returned to this country mutilated either spiritually or physically. Or psychologically, like my father was. Mm-hmm. And, you know, his suicide in 1976 is as a result of them not taking care of the men that they put in harm's way for no reason. And then when I went to go and get his records as a surviving child of a military member, you know what? They told me that they could prosecute me for falsely asserting that I was the child of a veteran.
Wow.
They lied about it. They have been brought. The records reemerged in 2007. Thank you very much. And were found by another researcher who dug them up for me. And I can prove that they falsified his record as well. They falsified it because he was part of something that was meant to be covered up. This is where they started the motivation, and I cannot let go because of that. Plus, I'm Sicilian. So,
oh no. Yeah.
Okay, you got problems here. I'm not going to go, and I'm going to put in every effort I can, and I don't care how many fraudsters come my way, and I don't care how many people try to, you know, cash in, make a buck, and play their games. We're going to get there. That's you just got my mentality in one shot about that, and that's why I won't let go. It's not the only thing I do. I don't allow myself to be, you know, consumed by it, and when it happens, you get a little consumed for a little while. You got to step back. I mean, I'm sure with this criminal stuff, you got to step back every once in a while and take a psychological shower. Because, I mean, look, first of all, there are plenty of people that you're right are getting off for the wrong reasons. There are plenty of people that don't get prosecuted that deserve to be.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. There's definitely what I saw on the NXIVM trial with Claire Bronfman, who funded the whole cult. This is Keith Raniere's cult I'm talking about.
Right.
And she bought herself. I mean, what you can buy when you're rich in our justice system is ridiculous. The advantages to being rich are ridiculous.
See, this
but
is
good
where,
luck.
Together.
Good luck trying to get lawyers to say, well, let's give the state this much money and you can only spend this much money on your trial. She spent she bought everybody's defense, all the defendants. but everybody pled out but the cult leader. So she spent $13 million on for everybody's lawyering on that. And that's what are we talking about? Like, I think I hope I'm not wrong here. Let's see, Nancy, Claire, Allison Mack, I think it's like six people, you know? That's ridiculous. That's a ridiculous amount of money. So, I mean, if we could make it more fair, I'm definitely for it. But, I mean, we're already seeing what the effects of this movement with the amount of crime going up, this the bail reform and everything. This is the end result. This is all connected to this. It's all connected to this movement. You know, it's really an anti-incarceration movement. They don't want anyone locked up. And it's scary.
Okay, but here's the problem, right? In my, you and I just came together, and now we're going to come apart again. Ready? Because as far as I'm concerned, being able to buy your result, this is not the country I was told I was born in.
No, right.
Okay, and you can buy that result as long as you are part of the moneyed class. Absolutely. You can buy it when it comes to medicine. You know what? If you're poor, so die. Get out of the way. You know what? You're poor. Doesn't matter if the system chews you up, and they do, okay, in a lot of cases. Now, it doesn't mean that some of these corrections are not insane, because some of it is. But the problem is, you mentioned, I don't know how you feel about the death penalty. I'll tell you how I feel about the death penalty. If I trusted the system, I'd be for it. Mm-hmm. But I can't trust this system because I know what the results are. People wind up losing years of their lives, losing their ability to fight in society altogether because sometimes they carry a plant with them. People lose all kinds of things because they violated, you know, really irrelevant things. They're not murderers, and they end up in prison longer than murderers sometimes.
Right.
This is not
right. No, we're going to agree on the war on drugs. It's a war we're never going to win. Never going to win. It's a ridiculous war that we're never going to win.
It's a war on people.
Yeah, that's different. It's vastly different. And I don't know why they don't spend time, you know, and then making the freaking prisons better. They're a wreck. So those things they're not interested in. They're interested. I'm talking about a movement, and it's very hard to. Very hard to comprehend that really is interested in freeing some of the most dangerous, creepy people that you wouldn't want to be near. And when they do get them released, they go right back into some of them go right back in the movement. So these people are working side by side with murders. And I'm talking about murders and rapists. Drug war is something different that we can totally agree on. As right. far as the system being unfair, it's not a perfect system. But, for example, one of the things that the Innocence Project wants to do this year, they put out, is they want to make the plea deals that you can plead to the same. So, basically, accepting guilt the same as, like, how do I explain it? It's such a convoluted, weird concept. So when you admit guilt, you get there's huge difference. Say, for example, let's take the next same trial. Okay. Ranieri went to trial. He got 120 years. Okay. Mm-hmm. Claire Bronfman got, what did she get? Like 6 3/4? I may be wrong on that. I think I'm right, but I think it's something around that in that thing because she pled out and admitted guilt. They want to make what you can get from a jury trial at the same level to what you could get for pleading guilty and taking a plea deal. That is insane. Basically, they're saying our sentences are too long in this country. That's what it means. They're too long forever. And on these very serious crimes, I don't know about you, but I don't want to be living next to Purvis Payne. I don't want him in my neighborhood. I don't want to be anywhere near that guy. You know, Stephen Avery, same thing. And the problem with having these guys around is and making them superstars, essentially, is what these podcasts are doing, is that they continue to abuse people from behind bars. And I can go more into that, but I think that's enough. That's enough of this depressing material. Let's get back to JFK.
Well, no,
what do you think of Garrison?
Why, you want more seriously. Depressed?
Seriously, do you think that he was right? I mean, do you think he was onto something, or do you think he was a kook? Or
Jim Garrison?
Yeah.
Jim Garrison kicked over a lot of stones he wasn't supposed to kick over. And frankly, the fact that the CIA literally, we know now, created a subgroup of individuals to go ahead and interfere with his investigation should tell you all you need to know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, was Garrison right? No, he wasn't. But with what he was working with, he kicked over somebody that they claimed for many years was not a CIA asset, and he was. He encountered a whole bunch of people that were involved in a whole lot of shady activity that, you know, our government was not supposed to be involved in. And he got himself in trouble that way.
Are you talking about Clay Shaw?
Clay Shaw was actually a trusted source and asset at one point. A CIA agent, but we now know that the accusations against him are actually true. But, you know, many, many years after he's gone, you know, years after Garrison's gone, you know, some of what he had to say was absolutely accurate. He had a lot of things wrong, though, Jim Garrison. But
so, okay, so I have one more question for you. So these people, like Judith Varybait, how do all the, like, I remember Rob Clark was reading, like, the top books on Amazon in the JFK research.
Yeah.
And, like, half of them are total, I don't know what, I just call it fraud, basically. Fraudulent books. How do the people who with the wrong information, is that by design, do you think? Or is that just that by coincidence that those people rise to the top of your, I don't know, what I'd call it a field of research?
No, it's actually a combination of things. First of all, you know, a certain salacious story that, you know, sounds good is easy to sell. I mean, the idea that, you know, there was this whole secret romance and all this stuff, to be honest with you, I think what helped Baker. And by the way, she is the only one in the field that I will definitively call a fraud, because that's a legally actionable word. And I live for the day that she tries to drag me into court, because she would have to assert the legitimacy of her claims in order to basically prove that I am harming her by calling her a fraud, because I know a little about the legal system. Do it, Judy, please.
Please, I'll report on that trial. I mean, that would be wonderful.
Where
the greatest? I mean, she's just, but she probably says she can't show up because she's afraid for her life.
Yes,
she's living in fear.
Right.
Of her and her weird dogs that she breeds.
Yeah, that, and, you know, and then
they're coming after her, you and her dogs.
You know, she's seeking asylum in Sweden, even though I had a guy on from the Swedish government who basically went, no.
She has asylum in Sweden. Sorry. I could talk about Judith Varybait all day.
Yeah,
I'm secretly fascinated. Now I'm really outing myself. If you're outing yourself as a true crime fan, I'm outing myself as secretly being fascinated with Judith Varybait.
If you
and
ever
her weird sideshow, wandering sideshow.
If you ever wish to devote a podcast to it just for fun, because you know what, we could talk about the alleged crimes that she absolutely confesses to in writing. That if anybody took seriously, I mean, she could be.
Oh yeah, isn't she giving people cancer and stuff?
Yeah, she literally confesses to being an accessory to murder in multiple cases. I mean, you know, come on, you want to do that someday?
Me
and Rob sit down and do it. It'll be fun.
I'd love to. Oh,
I'd
love it. I love all those episodes.
I love Rob. He hasn't been on the show in a while, but he's been a guest on my show. I have fun talking to Rob.
I don't listen.
Oh, your microphone cut out a little bit, Roberta. I don't know what happened. You moved around or something. Oh, boy. I hope I didn't lose you because you appear to be muted.
All right. Hold on. Is that better?
There you are. You're back. Okay.
Okay. Sorry. I'm turning on my
camera. Don't get too excited about Judy Baker, please.
So, I mean, I don't listen to many podcasts, but I rarely miss an episode of Rob Clark's. And I've listened to a lot of your JFK stuff, too. So if I'm going to listen, those are the two JFK podcasts I do listen to. Because I am interested. I mean, it really is the biggest unsolved true crime case. And
sure,
it goes on and on and on every year. And it just, I'm just frustrated as an outsider. I'm not an insider on this. I'm just an outsider looking in. I get frustrated because every year they say, or every couple of years they say, oh, there's going to be a big document drop. And it just, it's just nothing. I just don't know how it's going to be solved.
And you know, what's,
to go on.
You know, what's really scary is the stuff that we've discovered just based on the ancillary information from the document drops. I mean, the whole Northwoods proposal. You know, where they were going to use remote control jets to stage a terrorist attack near Cuba. This was proposed by the Joint Chiefs of Staff. This is absolutely provable in our hands, and it came through the JFK collection. You know, I mean, people don't even know the level of stuff. I mean, tracking down some of these paperclip type people that they brought over from Nazi Germany.
Oh yeah.
You know, some of them are connected to the case. You don't even know the nexus of madness. That you have to explore. It's absolutely insane between cryptonyms and withholding and redaction. And I mean, and that's just document research. I mean, don't get me started on the films, the people I've interviewed that are, you know, were participants, witnesses, Dallas cops. I mean, it's endless. But before we get way out of time here, I do have a couple other things to bring up. Okay. You did mention the Maxwell trial. Now,
yes.
I tried to cover that on this show a bit, and look, I couldn't get the likes of Roberta Glass to give me a report, okay? So I got Addie Adds, and I got Marlon Ettinger.
I love Addie, yeah.
Okay, and I got them to come on and tell me what it was they were seeing. Now, my attitude about that trial, ready, is I was surprised it even happened, first of all. And second of all, I was surprised that there was any sort of conviction because, sorry, I'm used to these types of people skating one way or another.
Well, I thought she might. I thought people don't realize how close that trial was. That was a very close trial. And I thought it was 60% chance she would get convicted, 40% chance she would get off.
Well,
and the defense was extremely good, and the prosecutors were good, but just overworked. I mean, this is a $7 million team. The oldest one on that for the government was 37 years old. So.
The craziest thing to me, though, let me give you my impressions, which will differ from yours, I think.
Yeah.
What I could observe there, I'm seeing that it seemed to me like the scope of the evidence that the prosecution used was very narrow.
Yeah.
It didn't bring in a lot of stuff. They brought in, you know, a handful of victims, okay, which I thought they would have had access to many, many more. And I realize it's bad to put on a bad witness. So certain people, you either needed to limit them or not show them. I get it. I understand strategy, right?
Mm-hmm.
But same time, so I'm looking at the prosecution going, they're not trying too hard is how I felt during. Mm-hmm. And then I look at the defense and I felt almost the same way. I'll give you a weird example. When they have all these photographs, right, and we know that for certain there's tons of photographic evidence possible in this case, they show up and basically it seemed to me like, and the impressions I got, again, I couldn't witness it, but if you went or if you had somebody there, they seem to say that, like, they entered, like, a handful of photographs, it seemed like, and all the proof in those photographs was like, look, Epstein is linked to Maxwell. And it's just like, okay, I get that you made that point. And I was surprised with, 5 out of 6 counts were guilty. I was surprised at that because it just seemed lackluster all the way around. I didn't feel very confident when the judge said, oh, this is, you know, too much for the public to see. I'm going, really? In 2021, this is too much for the public? And the other weird thing I saw is that, you know, look, this is going to take 6 weeks.
What do you mean too much for the public to see? What do you mean by that?
Well, the judge made a statement at the outset of the trial about not wanting to have the cameras in there, right?
Oh.
Where he was saying, you know, I don't think that we should broadcast this, you know, as – like I kind of have mixed feelings about that because, you know, once the public gets involved, you've only got one bite at the apple because – if it's too popular, you know, nobody's going to be untainted by whatever goes on. At the same time, you know, I feel like we should be able to see something like this. But the judge made this weird statement at the beginning there where he was like, I forget how he put it, but like, this is too dark and deep for the American public.
Send me that quote. It was a female judge, Judge Allison Nathan. I can tell you my feeling, but I know a lot of people. I don't know any New York trials that have been broadcast that I can think of, federal trials. I understand the disappointment. I think what you're getting at, and I understand some of it. I understand there's a decision they made with they had four victims.
Right.
There, and I've heard that complaint. I understand that complaint. I would love to find out more about how the government strategy really was in this trial, because we were told in the beginning it was going to be 6 weeks.
Right.
So, you know, I went every day except for one day I think I had a doctor's appointment, so I couldn't go.
Okay.
Because I thought, oh, it's 6 weeks, you know. Had I known it was only going to be 2 weeks, maybe I would have moved it or pushed it back or whatever. You don't know why they chose it. What I saw in the courtroom, and I was in the overflow room, that's my biggest gripe with the trial, is that it was held because of COVID. You just couldn't get into the courtroom. Yeah, I think Addie went one time at 3 a.m. and couldn't get in. So
right.
Meaning
right.
That the line started that early, and there we had mainstream press buying line placers for $100, and it became like a kind of Hamilton ticket type thing. If you had money and could afford a space holder, you could get into the courtroom, and there's just right. Very few seats. Most of the press were in one of the many overflow rooms, usually, you know, and in some ways that was really cool because you really got to know the people, like, and get sort of a core group, and you got to talk through the trial and that little bit heckle it and get to know the people around you. So that was fun. But as far as the trial goes, I don't know if I'm answering your question. I understand the frustration. There are rules for a federal trial, more complicated. I'm not a lawyer than I know with the scope of evidence. I think the frustration comes, and I had the same frustration with the NXIVM trial, is you want it to reveal everything. You want everything to come to the surface. And if you were going into the trial thinking that everything about Epstein and everything about Maxwell was going to come to the surface, then you were going to be really disappointed. This was it was a very narrow focus. Why they kept it so narrow, I would love to talk to them about what their strategy was. And you have to understand that Maxwell and Epstein particularly targeted girls that were troubled.
Mm-hmm.
So, and from poorer families. And so they could manipulate them, broken families, troubled people. And one, Carolyn, was extremely troubled. But she turned out to be the witness that they found the jury found the most unreliable. So you just don't know. And the people who, the independent journalists that I talked to, found her testimony the most moving and most convincing. So you don't know. The jury had no young white women on it. That was very odd. I felt like the defense just walked all over the government. And there's one Bobby Sternheim, one female lawyer, fantastic lawyer. She got almost all of her objections agreed upon. So they threw out two of the main criminal elements before the jury could even deliberate. Like, you could look at these charges, but you couldn't look at them as criminal or as a judgment against Maxwell's character. Then, I don't know how they got a conviction.
See,
it was so close.
You see what I mean, though? Okay, and then you look at the defense. Even they said at a certain point they leaked out, you know, we're going to have 30-something witnesses. They didn't do that either. So the whole thing was done. If it wasn't for the holidays, it might have gotten done in 10 days.
Yes.
You know?
I understand. I understand. I think that's a fair criticism of the trial.
You know, yeah. And I realize that you got to make decisions as you go, and a prosecutor could turn around. And I'm just saying, enough time observing cases in court, not just on TV, but in person, I realize that a prosecutor might make a strategic decision. You made your point with the jury. You don't want to overmake your point because you're going to kind of put them to sleep on it. You let that thing stick if you made the point, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe you have redundant witnesses that are going to say essentially the same thing. Maybe you compile them into one and you say, or two, you know, you limit it a little bit. Then maybe something comes up, an objection gets heard, and yeah, we can't bring this in. So therefore, well, maybe we don't need this witness now because we can't corroborate what they're saying with this other piece of evidence. I get all that. But mm-hmm. It just seemed to me like, and again, you were there a lot closer than I could have been. Addie was there, you know, and I got to say, I came away with this impression of like, it didn't seem like anybody was trying too hard. It didn't seem like anybody was going after, you know, what could have been the real big bad. And honestly, I almost felt like it was going to end with, you know, hung jury or something.
Well, do you think some of it is the fact that Epstein is dead and Maxwell is really... is what's left, and we really want to prosecute Epstein, you know? I mean, I feel that frustration. Do you think some of it's that?
That could be it, but on the other hand, then why didn't the defense really try and lay it off on the defense? I mean, because that's the perfect way to go with the defense. Look,
why didn't they do what? What did you want them to do? I'm trying to understand.
Like, in other words, when you're talking about the trafficking and all this stuff, why didn't they place that blame in the jury's mind all on Epstein? You know what I'm saying? Like, give it to the dead man. He's the one who did all this, actually.
They did. Oh, they did. That was their main thing. My client isn't on Epstein. My client, oh, yeah, that was the main thing. They hammer that home in closing arguments like crazy.
In the narrative.
And opening. I think Bobby Sternheim started to do that. Oh, it's ever since Adam and Eve, a woman, and then she tried to make it feminist. I wanted to throw up.
I understand that, but
a woman has been blamed for a man. Yeah. They did. I mean, it was a crafty defense. And no, I will tell you where I agree with you is in the questioning.
Let me just enter one more thing and then please analyze all of it. I see it in the narrative, in the opening and the closing, like you said, and in some of the arguments. But here's the problem. What did they enter into evidence to try and make that claim? Again, haphazard stuff going on with the defense. Well, do we have one of the black books? Not really. Do we have this employee? No, we don't. We got this other guy. You know what I mean? Like, you saw that going on, and I didn't see the defense say, well, look, we've actually got evidence, even if it's ridiculous, to try and get it entered. Right on, where it's like, look, really, this is not her doing. This is, you know, not her mens rea problem. This is the dead man's problem. It just seemed like they didn't actually enter the evidence to make the case. They just made the show of it because any judge will always instruct, right? Opening and closings, that's not evidence. Okay.
Well, they said that she lived separately. They tried to do that. They tried to pull that stuff. She lived here. She didn't live with him. She wasn't with him anymore. They tried to make that. But she was so intertwined with him. It was really hard to do. And I will agree with you on one point, which is the questioning of their star expert witness, Elizabeth Loftus. The favorite expert of the Innocence Project, the memory expert. And this is an expert, and I have a playlist, and I encourage everyone to go watch it. In the Durst trial, and she's been the expert witness for, she's helped the Ted Bundy team, Night Stalker. These are the people. Tim Hennis, she got out of prison paraded him around as innocent as all over these innocence conference till they found his DNA and he went, got tried militarily, very much like Purvis Payne crime. And he's now on death row. that she's been involved in. Weinstein, Cosby, she's just like, she's written a book called Witness for the Defense. She's on team criminal. She relates to, she loves pedophiles and murderers. Those are her people. They got her on the stand, right? And they, she did her fancy thing about how memory is not like a tape recorder, which as Ross Chade, who wrote a wonderful book called The Witch Hunt Narrative, has brought up, nobody says that memory is like a tape recorder. It's the biggest straw man argument in the world. But okay, she's up there doing her shtick. The jury is mesmerized by her. She has a 47-page resume. She's has incredible credentials. She's number 40, is it 48 or some or 49? I think it's 48 of top in some year top most important psychologists. Okay. The prosecutor Lewin in the Durst trial cross-examined her for over 4 days, I think, 4 or 5 days, and destroyed her. Destroyed her. They had the blueprint out there on how to destroy her credibility. They asked her maybe 10 questions, and it was not enough. They used some of the questions from the Durst trial. It was not enough. They had the blueprint on how to do it, and they didn't do it. Someone had already done it for them. And they just, like, they just looked overworked, underexperienced. And I'm not saying they're not good lawyers and they didn't work hard. They were just out experienced. And that was so obvious. And they also looked like they were not being given any support. I don't know. And you can call this a conspiracy, but I think the real conspiracy in this whole trial is the way that they were just thrown to the wolves, basically. That's what it was felt like. They were thrown to the wolves with no senior lawyer overseeing. Now, Audrey Strauss, who was supposed to try this, you still there? Am I talking to myself?
No, no, I'm still here. Okay. Yeah, I'm just listening.
So
yeah.
Audrey Strauss, who was supposed to try this trial, quit 2 months beforehand. Someone should interview her. What happened there? She's a really serious, what's the word, experienced attorney. Why was no senior experienced attorney, really experienced attorney? There's things you cannot learn in law school. Needed. There is an experienced attorney needed to oversee this group of young, inexperienced lawyers, and that was not given. What my understanding of the prosecutor's office in New York is it is in disarray, and that was so obvious in this trial. Now, was that done by design? Or was that, you can, that is the question to be answered. They were really, really thrown. But as far as, I can't agree with you as far as the defense not working hard. They were slick. Were they slick.
Okay, well, the only thing that I think you and I might be able to come to an agreement on here is that I think they decided to just get this out of the way, get it done, and get it gone. Because, you know what, if you dig deep enough, this gets way uglier and touches way more people. And you know what? I don't think anybody who is in power wants that. So why are they going to invest anything in it that is worthy of making that happen? That's how I feel about it. But, again, there's a lot of considerations there. And as far as that memory expert goes, just really quickly, the only thing that she says that's correct is that memory is subject to revision. It is.
Absolutely. 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 No one ever agrees in the world. I mean, it's just one straw man argument after another. I mean, nobody disagrees.
But that's the thing, is that you get past that point and the rest of it is a magic trick. It's a verbal magic trick, and I have never understood exactly the same thing. Like you said, they already had the blueprint on how to destroy her whole thing with the Durst people done. Absolutely. Can't disagree with you there at all. So before I end up just basically saying, where is it we can go get your podcast and all that, which I should have done already, but I'm over time a little bit. And frankly, I'm dragging you past time. I should have. but we started a little late. Sorry. Here's the thing. One last question about Innocence Project stuff, because I find this interesting. You know the tale of what went on with Henry Wade, right?
Henry Wade? No, I don't.
Okay, so Henry Wade, the guy who was supposed to prosecute Lee Harvey Oswald, and yes, indeed, that Wade name might sound familiar because Roe versus Wade, is indeed the now deceased former DA of Dallas, right?
Right.
And they overturned like 20 convictions in that jurisdiction. And quite frankly, I'd love for you to take a look at that and see what you think.
Yeah, I'd love to read the trial transcripts of the overturned convictions. Sure.
Because after going into those cases and understanding how the Dallas DA worked and that office and a lot of the corruption that was there.
Oh, there's definitely been corruption. There's definitely been bad DAs. I'm not saying that. I hope the audience doesn't go away with the idea that I'm saying our legal system is perfect or there are no wrongful convictions.
No, that's
certainly not my position.
It's just that you and I might differ on the degree to which the system is screwed up and exactly where the – but that's okay. I want to learn
– I hope it's interesting radio for podcast for people to listen to. Yeah, no, this has been a real pleasure. I've enjoyed it.
No, I want to do this again and get into some other stuff, if you don't mind. Some of the things that you've actually covered on your podcast a little more than just the – because you've done a ton of these things, and I covered a lot of true crime. I didn't even ask you about what you've really been working on recently, but just tell them where they can go get the true crime report, because, I mean, it's great. I pick it off of a couple of different places, but I know you're available just about everywhere. By all means, tell us where they should go, and if there's anything else that you'd like to promote out there. I want to do this again, though. Don't think for a second that I don't want to do this again.
Roberta Glass True Crime. It's called the Roberta Glass True Crime Report. iTunes, YouTube. Sometimes do live shows up there. I have one up now on Maxwell. I have a fourth year anniversary episode coming up with William Ramsey. I'm everywhere, every podcast place, Spotify, you can listen to it. That's where I am. And I really enjoyed it, Chuck. Thank you so much.
And my offer still stands. You want to do a show on Judy, I'm telling you.
Oh.
I'm Rob.
Oh, you and have done me twice. I just have to brush up a little. I've forgotten some of her tall tales.
You know what? It's endless. Absolutely endless. I mean, it is as endless as you think it's an endless array of charlatans. I can boil it down for you in the JFK community as for the greatest hits if you want someday, but she is the queen. I'm just telling you.
I agree. And I'm endlessly fascinated. It's her and Hilaria Baldwin. I think I put them in the same category.
I still would love a chance to talk to you about false memories and all kinds of stuff.
Oh, sure. Sure. Yeah.
And believe me, I appreciate you. Roberta Glass, again, Roberta Glass True Crime Report. And it's available everywhere where podcasts are, but I'm going to give you some specific links in the show notes. I want to thank you again for doing this with me, though.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Chuck.
Anyway, guys, the Ocelli Effect is done for tonight, so don't forget, no matter who you are, where you are, when you are, I am merely Ocelli, and all of you are indeed the effect. Good night.